Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
But few regions of the country have been hurt worse than Suffolk. You know that.
And it wasn't until I went to his rally, and it totally blew me away. I left there crying, you know, choking up. I'm like, oh, my God.
Suffolk Nassau region of New York has lost more than half of its manufacturing jobs. That's not good, folks.
I just can't believe that this man, with all his money and all that he could be doing right now, like, he'd want to make a difference here.
We should offer hardworking, law-abiding immigrant families a path to citizenship.
I love this country. You are a citizen. You believe in the Constitution. So learn about the country where you live. Google it.
So this isn't about race. It's about people who break the law, the people who put our kids at risk, and every color, race that are affected by it. It's all inclusive. It's all about humans.
In one day, boom, your dream go down.
God bless the United States of
anxiety.
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 Anxiety. Anxiety.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a podcast by WNYC Studios and The Nation magazine. As I said last week, our focus here is not really November 8th. That's a big, important day when we will all have our say about the direction in which we want the country's next president to lead us. But regardless of who wins, on November 9th, we will still have to deal with the profound anxieties this campaign has revealed among Donald Trump's supporters. A group of people who, according to the polls, are largely white, mostly without college degrees, but mostly doing pretty well financially. They've got jobs, they own businesses, they've benefited from the social contract of the 20th century. And yet, they are scared of what comes next. So we're trying to understand what has them feeling so afraid and uncertain. This week, we back up and look at what they had to lose in the first place and how they came to get it. First, WNYC's Arun Vanagopal checks in with Patty Dwyer and meets her mom. They explain why their family left the city and staked their claim in some of America's very first suburbs.
They call me Chatty Patty. I wonder why. I don't know.
That's her. Patty is a respiratory therapist and a strong supporter of Donald Trump and has lived almost her entire life on the South Shore of Long Island.
I live in Brookhaven, Brookhaven Hamlet, and I'm, what do you know, I'm 60 years old. Of course, by looking at me, you'd never know that. No, I'm only kidding. You know, I'm happily married to the love of my life. We reconnected at the 40th high school reunion, so we're only married not quite 2 years now. We knew each other in junior high school and high school, and fate just brought us together. So
Patty was just two when her family moved out to the suburbs. This was in the late 1950s, when a lot of families were beginning to leave cities. And I wondered, what brought this family here from New York? So I went to the village of Patchogue, where Patty grew up, and I asked her mom, Pat Johnson. Mrs. Johnson, I called her.
How long have you lived here?
February will be 50 years.
Wow. 50 years.
50 years I live here. So, where would you like to sit?
This is perfect. Right, I'll sit here if you could sit there.
Yeah, this is my...
That's your place.
Spot. It knows me. I have to just watch for the... If I jump up and run, that's my mailman. He's going to bring me some...
Oh, okay.
Stamps, hopefully.
Mrs. Johnson's about to turn 81.
And thank God, I think I still have my marbles. I'm retired for 26 years from working for the state.
Just like her daughter Patty does today, Mrs. Johnson worked at a hospital, Pilgrim State, a mental institute, and by some measures, the largest psychiatric facility in the world. It had been built to relieve overcrowding at psychiatric facilities in New York City at a time when they were bursting at the seams. But before she worked at Pilgrim State, Mrs. Johnson was a young mother with three little kids living in Jamaica, Queens, when something happened.
And they moved out, my in-laws. They bought a house and they left. And it was a very old house. We had the small apartment downstairs. And this sounds funny, but it was nerve-wracking for me because my husband at that time worked at night. He drove a cab in the city. And I was alone with the kids downstairs in this little, and all empty upstairs, a couple floors. So it was creepy, you know. And one night I took the kids to Jamaica Avenue. We went shopping and I come home. And after I was home for a very short time, when you first walked in the big door, it was like a little hallway. And then I opened the door to go into my little apartment. And I heard someone knock at the door. So I went out and I said, "Who's there?" Nobody answered. And I had like a stained glass. And I saw someone standing there, but just the outlet because I couldn't see, you know, other because of the color. And I kept saying, "Who's there? Who's there?" And whoever it was wouldn't answer me. Well, it scared me to death. So I ran back in and I locked the door and made sure the windows were locked. And I didn't know what to do. I was scared stiff. So long story short.
Nothing happened. No one was hurt. And she never saw this mysterious shadow again. But that was enough. Mrs. Johnson decided she had to leave the city. Fortunately, she had an uncle who owned a summer home out on Long Island in Farmingville.
And I loved it out here already because we used to come out to my uncle's house in the summer and visit, you know, and spend time out here. So that was how I wound up out here.
Along with her kids and her first husband. This was in January of 1958, a time when lots of people, especially young families, were moving out of cities and into suburbs. These were German, Italian, Jewish, and Irish families in search of bigger homes and safer neighborhoods, and driven by a fear that cannot be separated from the racial dynamics of the time. Urban neighborhoods like Jamaica were starting to face the realities of integration. Black people were moving in, and although many of these people were professionals, members of the middle class, real estate brokers and politicians were now sowing fear among white residents about that change.
What happened was they would go door to door in areas that were in transition.
Andrew Beveridge is a demographer who has closely studied the population changes that took place in post-war Brooklyn and Queens.
And they would say, "The blacks are coming, your property values are going to hell, sell out now." And they would push them to sell at a fairly low number. And then they would turn around and resell the house to a black at a pretty high number.
Now, Mrs. Johnson insists her own fears had nothing to do with race, and I believe that's true. But for many of her neighbors in Jamaica and other Queens neighborhoods like St. Albans and Laurelton, the campaign to stoke white fear succeeded. In the 1950s, as the city's black population rose, the white population plummeted. In that same decade, Suffolk County, where Farmingville is located, exploded in size, growing at a pace it never had and never again would. Aspiring members of the white middle class, firefighters, cops, veterans, were told they could have it all.
But of course, not everyone could have it all. We've set this podcast in the suburbs because we think the suburbs as a place and all it represents, that's part of the story of this political moment. Mrs. Johnson's experience was not unusual. One big important force behind the suburbanization of America was fear.
There's a national obsession with the fall of youth after World War II and a federal concern with kind of intervening in it.
Kwame Holmes is an assistant professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's finishing a book on the political and cultural history of suburban Washington, D.C. And he says, if you want to understand how that mid-century concern about the kids continues to haunt our politics today, there's no better place to look than the suburbs around our nation's capital. It began right after the Supreme Court's 1954 order to desegregate the schools.
Certainly there are none who believe that all states would react calmly to the Supreme Court decision putting an end to segregation in the public schools. This is and has been an issue which, like it or not, we had to face eventually.
When Brown v. Board is handed down by the Warren Court, the Eisenhower administration basically gives the city no choice. They immediately implement integration in the public schools.
Most states had messy local fights over whether or not to follow the court's ruling. Some are still having it, honestly. But D.C. is actually controlled by the federal government. So Eisenhower, he was able to push past all of that, which made the city sort of a national test case for integration.
The stakes are super high, right? So Southern lawmakers are wanting to discredit it, and liberals are wanting to point to it as a model.
But the D.C. Oversight Committee in Congress was led by those same Southern lawmakers. And they used a familiar tool to control the debate, a congressional investigation. In September of 1956, they held a series of scandalous hearings to discuss the results. The proceedings could have made Donald Trump blush.
And they are concerned about three shifts that they argue are the result of African Americans' presence in white schools.
First, they say that black kids have lower IQs, and that basically they're making the white kids dumber. And not just by dumbing down the curriculum.
But also in a kind of weird, like, evolutionary understanding that there'll be, like, a kind of syncing up that will happen.
Second, they say black kids are just petty criminals, that white kids are forced to lock up their valuables for fear of getting ripped off. But finally, and maybe most importantly, there's the big one. Sex.
Yeah, they are pretty shameless. And, I mean, these things are even challenging to repeat. It's like, talk about one young student was accused of exposing himself to a teacher. Young black girls are apparently writing obscene language on the bathroom walls, telling white girls about new language, new swear words.
They go on and on about high rates of venereal disease and about teen pregnancy. And all of this stuff, Holmes says, it gets permanently lodged in the American psyche.
The absolute power that parents can wield over their children's innocence, their right to control that, becomes the rationale for segregationist patterns of movement in and out of cities.
White families fled D.C., and the surrounding suburbs boomed. The same white flight was gearing up all over the country at the time, and it would intensify as the real estate industry took advantage of the very same fears those Southern legislators stoked. They pushed families out of the cities with fear, then pulled them into the suburbs with social engineering designed to create a white middle class. But a very particular type of white middle class.
The underwriters at the Federal Housing Authority, who are designing policy that will subsidize suburbanization, are really crafting that policy and wanting to only recommend that loans be given to married white men who plan to have children.
And thus, the stereotypical suburban life of mid-century television was created.
Margaret, do you know what's wrong with this family?
Apparently, we break too many windows.
That's more than that. It's everybody's complete disregard for responsibility. The inability to...
A nuclear family led by a man in an all-white community where kids are safe from the depravities of integration. But Kwame Holmes says there's an important twist to that story. Go back to those D.C. suburbs and fast forward a decade to the 1966 Maryland gubernatorial campaign. The year before the vote, fights over Jim Crow were a big part of the state's politics. The legislature took up bills dealing with both interracial marriage and housing segregation. And in both cases, the segregationists narrowly won. Then, the following year, Republican Spiro Agnew, who would go on to become Nixon's vice president, faced Democrat George P. Mahoney for the governor's office.
And Mahoney really runs on a virulently anti-integrationist campaign, and he really stokes a lot of anxiety around the potential of black penetration of the home. His slogan is, your home is your castle, protect it.
And this should work, right? Here's a state filled with all-white suburbs, many of them created by parents who were running from their dark visions of integrated schools and in a charged climate because of the legislature's recent votes. But it doesn't work. Mahoney loses.
For the white parents who have moved into the suburbs over the course of the 1950s and 1960s, once they've secured their own children's innocence within racially homogenous schools in the suburbs, it seems to free them up to be more in support of integration in an abstract and general sense. It's like the liberalism that you could never actually engage in your private life, you can advocate as good for the state or good for the nation.
Put another way, there's a yawning gap between what white Americans believed about their lives and the lives they chose to live. Holmes says that gap, that psychic disconnect, is still with us today.
So there's a way in which you can engage in racist activity to protect your kids, and then you have a kind of double whammy where protecting kids means not communicating to them the actual reason for their lifestyle and the way things look. So they can grow up innocent of that as well. And potentially right now, I think that when people say our kids won't have what we had, maybe what they're also lamenting is that their kids cannot be innocent of racial injustice any longer. And so part of this frustration that could be animating the Trump supporter is that there is no way for the suburb to do the work it used to do, right? To contain childhood innocence, because the media and the globalization of information has made that impossible.
After the break, we will return to Long Island to get a sense of why this suburb, where household incomes are well above the national median and the unemployment rate is below 4.5%, has so many people who believe America is on the wrong track. But first, we are hearing from you, and you are letting us know that this anxiety runs on both sides of this election.
Nas from Queens, you're on WNYC. Go ahead.
We're broadcasting every Thursday night on WNYC, and last week, we got a call from Nas, who works on Long Island.
The rhetoric between Republicans and Democrats just seems so starkly different. The rhetoric from Trump seems to lack basic empathy for Muslims, specifically, since I'm a Muslim myself, but for other minorities too. And you know, usually I don't really fall into political lines, but I really do feel scared that if Trump becomes president, it would be a dark turn in history for me and my other friends as well.
What's happening in your community that's making you feel anxious? Give us a call at 646-783-9692.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory, and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
America has a funny relationship with itself. We are still a relatively young country, and since the beginning, we've always looked forward. We had the space to expand, we had the resources to develop, and we had a profound belief in our own good intentions and innocence, and the prosperity that all of that can bring us. But the facts are a little different. As WNYC's Arun Venugopal found out as he started digging into Long Island's past.
You live across the Sound in West Egg. I know somebody there.
I don't know a single person.
You must know Gatsby.
Oh, he's my neighbor.
Gatsby? What Gatsby?
So here's something I did not know. In the 1920s, at the same time that The Great Gatsby was set, Long Island had an enormous Klan presence. By the estimate of one historian, Neil Buffett, one in seven Long Islanders were members of the KKK. This was during the Klan's heyday, when important public officials openly courted the group's members and marched along with them.
We're white people.
Yeah.
We're standing up for white rights. The Klan is the only organization that stands up for the white rights.
Yeah.
In the 30s, the German Settlement League operated a camp on Long Island, Camp Siegfried, located in the town of Yaphank, not far from where Patty's family moved to. Every summer, kids and adults of, quote, Aryan blood would come stay in cabins here and walk down Hitler or Goebbels Street wearing German military uniforms. Outside, there was a large hedge in the shape of a swastika. But as anti-German sentiment escalated during the war, the camp was dismantled. In the post-war period, things changed.
Today, Long Island is America's new major market,
with the highest spendable income per household in the nation.
The first modern suburb, Levittown on Long Island, was created in direct response to the enormous pent-up demand for housing after the war. And the ideals on which the Long Island suburbs were built remain a powerful part of the psychology of the place: safe, secure, and segregated. Lawrence Levy runs the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University.
You could be a black man working on the road crews, building it, but you couldn't even get in the door of the sales office to get an application, much less move your family there. They were invisible barriers, and black families, after a while, didn't even try.
And the pattern was set. Long Island remains, to this day, one of the most segregated suburbs in America. Of course, not everyone who moved here was specifically thinking about segregation. Levy said that for many people who were drawn to Long Island from New York City, the appeal of Levittown and surrounding communities wasn't necessarily a whites-only environment so much as space.
It was such a Garden of Eden for them. It was a place where dreams could be realized.
It was certainly Eden for Mrs. Johnson.
It was all country then, all dirt roads. Oh, I loved it.
For most of her life, Mrs. Johnson didn't pay much attention to racial politics.
I went to work and I worked with black people and everybody I worked with, you know, Hispanics and black, everybody. But I never thought of, I have no prejudice.
In fact, she generally didn't pay attention to politics. She barely recalls which candidates she voted for in presidential races over the decades, whether she even voted at all. She pretty much just relied on her husband.
Bill was, he was smart as a whip, let me tell you. I mean, he knew everything. He was but very quiet man, but he was very, very smart. And it's sad to say, but I didn't pay much attention. I just say, at voting time, I'd say, who are we going to vote for? You know, and that's the way it was.
LBJ, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush too. Mrs. Johnson was fairly apolitical. It was only during the Obama era, she says, that she started paying close attention. This was several years after the death of her husband. She liked Obama, thought he projected strength. Hillary, she doesn't like at all. Trump, on the other hand, is promising. And despite statements he's made against certain groups, she thinks he's got a good heart.
He's friends with them and he hires them. He hires people deliberately because of their minorities. Why would he be against them? He's not. He's not really.
Mrs. Johnson clearly has such close connections to people of different backgrounds. She's genuinely pained by racial divisions, like the death of Eric Garner at the hands of police.
What horrible thing to happen, you know? And it was like a white cop. But all of us aren't bad either. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I'm kind of religious anyway, and I think to myself, one of these days, the good Lord's going to say, I had enough of these people. Let's get rid of them all, you know. And he'll just... I'm glad I'm on my way out and not my way in to this world, because I wouldn't want to be living here and going through this if I was young. Because what have they got to look forward to? Any kids nowadays? All kids.
But you think Trump is the right guy for this moment?
I do. I do. I think he's going to do something. I really and truly believe he's going to try to straighten out this country, because it's bad. It's really bad.
Why Donald Trump? For one, she thinks, just like her daughter does, that Trump, with all his wealth, could be doing anything, anywhere, and that he certainly wouldn't need to be serving as president if he weren't totally committed to it. At the same time, she thinks he projects strength on issues like immigration, especially with his pushback against allowing refugees into the country.
It's not right. I'm sorry. I feel bad for people that are oppressed, and I mean oppressed. You know, I read some of the things, it breaks my heart, what they do to women especially. But, you know, if we got to take care of our own too.
And I think this pretty much sums up Mrs. Johnson's worldview. It's not that she's indifferent to the pain of the world. She just thinks America needs to prioritize. Right now, for Mrs. Johnson, the biggest problems aren't out there, but right here at home. Her house, the place where she's lived for nearly 50 years, half a century, has become an impossible burden because of constantly increasing property taxes.
Now I pay almost $3,763 every 6 months, twice a year.
So about $7,500 a year.
Compared to about $1,200 when they first bought the house. And back then, she and her husband, even if they were never exactly wealthy, they were both earning. Now he's gone, and she's been forced more and more to draw from his pension. She's taken out a second mortgage as well, and uses her Social Security payments to pay for her property taxes. So she increasingly wonders if it makes any sense to hold on to this home that she's lived in for nearly 50 years. Her friend implores her not to sell, says she'd have to pay through the nose if she becomes a renter. But continuing as a homeowner, that is a constant juggling act, and she has no idea how long she can keep it up.
My washing machine died this past year, but then 2 months later, my stove died. So my daughter gave me the money for the stove. She gave me $700 for my stove. She's been good. She's been trying to help me. And I'm so independent, it hurts. I hate it. I never... I never asked anyone for anything, ever. And I've been taking care of this house by myself since my husband died. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be. But it's like an old saying, like maybe you heard of robbing Peter to pay Paul. That's what I have to do every month almost. But I do it. You know, I rather do that than ask, and I never ask. So, life's not easy. Not anymore. Can I fix you a cup of coffee?
Life's not easy anymore for a lot of people in America's Edens. We talk a lot about the way household income fell during the Great Recession. But here's a stat we overlook. During the boom years that came right before the crash, between the 2001 recession and the recession that began in 2007, household income also fell. That was an important marker we did not see at the time. It was the very first time income had fallen outside of a recession since World War II. So that means something did change fundamentally in the course of Mrs. Johnson's suburban life. Things did get measurably harder. And a lot of people feel like things got a lot less safe, too.
You don't know who's coming in. You don't know who's jumping a fence. Did that person commit a crime? Are they trying to escape? Do we want a person like that in this country? Are they going to do it again?
That's next week. I'm Kai Wright.
The United States of Anxiety is produced by WNYC Studios and The Nation Magazine. Reporting this week by Arun Venugopal and produced by myself, Joseph Capriglione. It's recorded and mixed by Bill Moss and Casey Means. Our theme music was composed by Nathan Halpern. Karen Frillman is our editor and executive producer, along with Kai Wright.